So, most of you know that after I graduated from seminary, I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. I didn't go to seminary specifically to be a pastor. I went to seminary in part because I had always, after I'd gotten saved, I've always loved academics, and I loved studying the Word of God. And so even when I was in seminary, I loved to study, and I loved to study just kind of verse by verse. I wouldn't say trained in it. Nobody taught me that. It's just kind of what I liked doing. I would take my Bible out, and if you could see the Bible that I had in college, you'd see words are highlighted and underlined and arrows and stuff like that. And so I even began to teach, and I knew that I really enjoyed teaching the Word of God. And so I had thought about going on to seminary, but you know, it's expensive, and after spending 5 years in college, and you know. So when I met Pastor Krenz and he had encouraged me to go on to seminary, I took that as an opportunity to go, but I wasn't really sure what I was going to do with it. I didn't want to be a full-time pastor. I just didn't see myself filling that role. I thought I was going to go into Christian radio, and I, you know, at one point I thought I was going to go with Josh McDowell Ministries to do public speaking. In fact, I was accepted into his ministry to be trained personally by him. But I really wasn't sure. And so when I graduated, instead of jumping off into something, I just decided to stay around Warsaw, Winona Lake, and I continued to pastor this small country church. And it was a great ministry. God did some neat things there. And I got the opportunity to move here. Most of you kind of know that. And I moved here and I helped start a church down in Grove City that I pastored for a while. And we ended up merging that church into the parent church. Grove City at the time was a tough, tough area because literally we met in an old house where the kids, we had our Sunday school in the kitchen, and it just really was terrible. And finally got to the point where nobody wanted to rent to churches. In fact, another place we had stopped renting to churches. The schools didn't want to open up their doors. And so finally we decided, you know, it'd just be a lot easier to merge in with the parent church. And at that point I was kind of like, well, what am I going to do now, you know? So we started thinking about, you know, where we might move to, and we needed a bigger house because the house that I had purchased as a single wasn't going to be conducive to a family. And so we kind of drew a circle on the map, and we'd love to be in the Delaware area because there were a lot of Grace Brethren churches all within 15, 20-minute drive, and I thought that's what God wanted me to do was, boy, go here and I could get a job at any one of these churches, maybe as a part-time pastor, etc. Well, through that whole process, we ended up at Grace. And part of that was because Pastor Custer and another pastor, Pastor Steve, when I would visit with my wife Amy, they would pull me aside and say, we want you to stay. We want you to stay. We want you to stay, you know. And finally, I thought, okay, this is God's plan. He wants me here. So I figured it would be really easy to get plugged in and to start to teach again. But that didn't happen. In fact, after being there for about 6 months, Pastor Jim pulled me aside and he said, how come you're not an elder yet? And I'm like, I don't know. He's like, well, you should be an elder. And I'm like, you got to talk to your elder board, you know. And so he talked with the elder board, and that went through sort of a process and stuff. And I kept looking for opportunities to teach and other things. And to be real honest, no opportunities, no interest. Jim, every once in a while, would say, well, what are you doing here? I'm like, I don't know. I'm trying. I've gone to the person who heads all the Bible studies and the ABFs. And I got invited to preach one time, so I was able to preach one time there. But, like, nothing. And so for almost 2 years, I did nothing. And I really, it was distressing. It was disappointing. It was frustrating. Especially since there were Sunday schools that didn't have teachers. And so finally, Steve Schmeckel and I just kind of said, we're just going to do our own thing. And we found a room, you know, and we kind of started our own little Sunday morning Bible thing. And some of you know that I ended up teaching ultimately the New Beginnings class. But for 2 years, literally did nothing. And I really wonder, God, what happened here, you know? This is where I thought you wanted me to be. This is where I thought you wanted to use me. You know, I went through the whole seminary thing, and I can't even teach in a big church that needs help with teaching. What, you know? So it was a difficult and a challenging time. When I think about Jacob here, and I think about his life, think about how when he left his home to travel to get a wife, and the Lord appeared to him and made him all these promises, And yet, 20 plus years later, nothing had happened. He had gotten a wife and stuff, but he's kind of stuck in Panarum. And God finally calls him and wants to take him back home. And we're going to see how that kind of works out today. But I think about Jacob. I wonder if Jacob ever, in his own mind, kind of wondered, well, wait a minute, what about those promises some 20 years ago? Well, isn't something supposed to happen with that, Lord? But I'm still here slogging through the mess, you know, working for this guy that I don't like. He's been trying to rip me off, you know. I don't have an estate for my own family. I can't take care of them. What happened to all those promises? All those big plans you had for me? I wonder if he ever struggled with that or wondered about that. Well, what we look at today, we're going to see how after Jacob had left Pan-Aram, when God had called him to go back, after serving Laban for 20 years, God calls him back. And there's two things that happen in our text today. He reminds Jacob of his plans and the vow that Jacob had made to him. And then we see how God worked to ensure that those things that he promised would actually come about. So we see those two things in our passage today. The Lord reminding Jacob of his plan for him and the vow that he had made. And then how God had worked to protect those things, because those things look like they're in jeopardy at this point with Laban and Jacob. So we're going to go ahead and look at those two things here today. We're in chapter 31. And let me just set the table with this. After serving Laban for 20 years, God spoke to Jacob, and he told him, go back home to your family. So God is now calling Laban to leave the place that he had been for some 20 plus years to go back home. As we saw last week, as a result of Jacob's success in finally building his own estate, Laban's sons had become jealous, they had become angry with him, they had accused him of some things. Laban's face, Jacob said, was no longer friendly towards him. So God commands him to go back to his home. And he reminded him of two things when he did that. Look at verse 31, or chapter 31. We're going to look at the first few verses here. Now Jacob heard the words of Laban's son saying, Jacob has taken away all our fathers, or all that was our father's, and from what belonged to our father he has made his wealth. Jacob saw the attitude of Laban, and behold, it was not friendly toward him as it was formerly. And then you see the call of God here. So the first thing the Lord reminds him of here is found in verse 3. Then the Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers and to your relatives. And he says, I will be with you. That's a reminder of the promise that God had made to him previously. I want you to jump over to chapter 28 and keep your finger on 28, because we're going to come back here in a second. But chapter 28, if you look at verses 10 through 15, this was God's promise when he promised Jacob that he would be with him. Chapter 28, verses 10 through 15. Then Jacob departed from Beersheba and he went toward Haran. He came to a certain place and spent the night there because the sun had set, and he took one of the stones of the place and put it under his head and lay down on it in that place. He had a dream, and behold, a ladder was set on the earth and its top reaching to the heaven, and behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac, and the land in which you lie, I will give it to you and to your descendants. Well, that's the land of Bethel. That's just north of Beersheba. So it's in the region where his family was, where his home was. He says, I'm going to bring you back here and give this to your descendants. That's God's promise. Verse 14, the descendants will also be like the dust of the earth. That's another promise. And you will spread out to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. In other words, in all of the land of Canaan. He says, and in you and in your descendants shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Those are the promises that God made to him. He also goes on into verse 15. Behold, I am with you, and I will keep you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. So the first thing, when you're back in chapter 31, the first thing that we see there, he reminds Jacob of that. In verse 3, he says, return to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I will be with you. The second thing that God reminds Jacob of was the vow that Jacob had made to him. If you jump down into verse 13 of chapter 31, God said to him, I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar, where you made a vow to me. Now arise, leave this land, and return to the land of your birth. Now again, back to chapter 28. We see where Jacob made this vow. Look at verse 16 of chapter 28. Jacob awoke from his sleep, and he said, surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. He was afraid and said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. So Jacob rose early in the morning, and he took the stone that he put under his head, and he set it up as a pillar, and he poured oil on it. He called the name of that place Bethel, which means house of God. However, previously the name of the city had been Luz. Then Jacob made a vow, saying, if God will be with me and will keep me on this journey that I take and will give me food to eat and garments to wear, and I return to my father's house in safety, another way to read that is, and he returns me to my house in safety, then the Lord will be my God. This stone which I have set up as a pillar will be God's house, and all that you give me I will surely give a tenth to you. And so Jacob makes this vow. And so what we see in chapter 31 is when God calls Abraham, go back home, he reminds him, I'll be with you. So he reminds him of his promises, and then he says, and remember the vow you made to me, which was what? That if God brings me back home, he will be my God. Now, think about this for a moment. Neither God's plan for Jacob or for the world, nor Jacob's promise could be fulfilled in Mesopotamia, where he was. Because that wasn't God's plan. And Jacob didn't vow to worship him if he kept him in Mesopotamia. And so what we really see here is that God's promises specifically involved Jacob and his descendants going back to the land of Canaan, where they would fill the land, possess the land, and as a result of that, all the families on the earth would be blessed. That's God's plan. It could not be fulfilled in Mesopotamia. That's not what God intended. Likewise, Jacob's vow was based on the promise would bring him back. So likewise, his vow could not be fulfilled in Mesopotamia either. And so that's what's at stake here. God is reminding Jacob of his plan and his vow and his role in that plan. So what does Jacob do? Look at chapter 31. Our primary text for today starts in verse 17. Chapter 31, verse 17. Then Jacob, after God had told him, go back home, then Jacob arose and he put his children and his wives upon camels, and he drove away all his livestock and his property which he had gathered, and his acquired livestock which he had gathered in Padan Aram, to go to the land of Canaan to his father Isaac. When Laban had gone to shear his flock, then Rachel stole the household idols that were her father's. Then Jacob deceived Laban, the Aramean, by not telling him that he was fleeing. So he fled with all that he had, and he arose and crossed the Euphrates River and set his face toward the hill country of Gilead. So what does Jacob do? He obeys the Lord. The Lord says it's time to go. And you know, Jacob was ready to leave. It had been a long time. He was facing the accusation of Laban's sons who were angry with him. Laban wasn't happy with him anymore. And so Jacob was probably ready to leave, and so the Lord steps in and tells him to leave. But we're going to see that there was a little bit of trepidation as well. A little bit of fear, if you will, in leaving because of the way that he goes about doing it. It says that he left while Laban was away shearing his sheep. He didn't say goodbye to Laban. In fact, the text here says that he deceived Laban. That word is not the normal word for deceived. It's that he stole his heart, which basically means that the way that he went about doing it impacted Laban emotionally. The words fled and fleeing indicate that he was running, that he was afraid of Laban. He knew Laban would not respond kindly to what he was doing. He was already in Laban's bad graces because Laban had tried to rip him off multiple times. And remember what God had done? Every time Laban tried to rip off Jacob, God turned the tables. And so as a result of that, Laban's flock decreased, his wealth decreased, while Jacob's wealth increased. So now Laban wasn't happy about it. His sons weren't happy about it. Makes sense that Jacob would be a little bit afraid of leaving. So he does it, I might say, in the dead of night. Doesn't say that specifically, but he leaves without telling Laban. Later in verse 31, we see why he feared, because, in fact, I'm going to just jump ahead and read it. Then Jacob replied to Laban, this is when Laban finally caught up with him, "Because I was afraid, for I thought that you would take your daughters from me by force." So he was afraid that Laban would use violence to prevent him from leaving and taking his wives. In fact, we know that's exactly what Laban would have done, because, and you don't have to jump here, but later in the chapter in verse 43, even after Laban realized what was going on and that he wasn't going to get to keep his daughters, that God wasn't going to allow that to happen, he tells Jacob, "The daughters are my daughters, and the children are my children, and the flocks are my flocks, and all that you see is mine." So Jacob had good reason to be afraid, to be intimidated. Something else that might have added to Jacob's trepidation about returning to his family was obviously knowing he was going to have to meet up with Esau. Because, remember, he left because Esau was trying to kill him. He had deceived his brother. His brother therefore sought to kill him. So he ran away. He's been gone for 20 years, but we're going to find out in a future text that he still thought that Esau was mad and that Esau was going to kill him. And so he has a number of things here that are causing trepidation in Jacob. But I think it's important that we point out here that in spite of that, when God said go, Jacob went. That's the important thing here. In spite of the fears or the concerns that he had, Jacob did obey God, and he set out for home, which suggests that he was going to have to trust the Lord. And he took him at his word. "I will be with you, Jacob." And so the first thing I want to see in this passage is that it would appear that God makes this promise to Jacob, but 20 plus years go by without fulfilling that promise. And it's almost as if that promise was just sort of forgotten or suspended. Jacob's life during that time was a little rocky. You know, he was deceived. He got two wives instead of one wife. And, you know, then the battle between the wives and the babies and being confronted by Rachel. And, you know, and then the whole thing with, "I got to start to save for my family." And that didn't go great initially, because the whole process started with Laban trying to trick him. And then during that, how many years? Probably 6 years or so at least, maybe 7 years. Laban's constantly trying to rip him off, and we find out a little bit later in a later text that during that whole time, there were times where things happened to Laban's flock where Jacob had to cover the cost too of that. You know, just it was a difficult period. But God didn't forget his promise. God didn't forget his plan with Jacob. Even though it might seem like that from Jacob's perspective, that's not what happened. And so God reaches out, reminds Jacob not just of his plan, but of Jacob's vow, his role in that plan. So what's the takeaway for us? I would say it this way. Since its inception, God's redemptive plan has always been accomplished through people. And his plan was to ultimately bring salvation through Christ to all the world, but it would go through Jacob. That was God's plan. And that may not stand out here, but that's exactly the way that it works. If you follow the thread of God's redemptive plan all the way through the Old Testament into the New Testament, it went through people, including Abraham, then Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, down into David, Solomon. It just, that's the way it works. God always uses and includes people in this plan, and we see that here with Jacob. He didn't forsake Jacob. Remember what he told him was, "I will not forsake you until I have accomplished what I said I would do." So even though at times it may seem like, well, I thought you wanted me as part of your plan, God. Much like me sitting up at Grace and going, well, wait a minute, Lord, what in the world? I thought the plan was go to seminary and I teach and I use those gifts and abilities and the skills you taught me, but here I am sitting on my hands. What role do I play in all this? God didn't forget. He had a plan and an intent. Part of us being here today is part of that. It's the way God works it out. And so his redemptive plan has always been accomplished through people, and he doesn't abandon them or forsake them. Second takeaway here is that sometimes we need to be reminded of God's plan and the role that he expects us to play in it. Just like Jacob. The Lord tells him, remember what I promised you? Now go back. Remember the vow you made to me. Now go back. God blessed Jacob while he was in Mesopotamia. There's no question about that. But that wasn't his plan, just to bless Jacob there. Jacob, really, by the time he gets ready to leave, he's got a pretty sizable estate. He's got a lot of animals, a lot of servants, a bunch of kids with wives, right? But that wasn't God's ultimate plan, just to bless him in Mesopotamia. The plan was to take him back to the land, because God's plan was bigger than just blessing Joseph or Jacob in Padan Aram. In the same way, God blesses us here in this life, doesn't he? I was really blessed at seminary. But I don't believe that that was God's ultimate plan. He moved me here to Columbus, where I met my wife, had some babies. That's not God's ultimate plan. It's part of it. I don't know where he'll take us going forward. But much like Jacob, his plan extended beyond Jacob to the earth, to the people, to the families of all the earth, right? Think about that in a moment for us. God blesses us wherever we're at. We're here and now. And that's part of his bigger plan. But it isn't his bigger plan. Does that make sense? That's not where it all ends. A lot of times as Christians, we kind of get stuck. And we live in this life, and we enjoy the place we're at. Much like Jacob was in Padan Aram. I wonder if the sons of Laban hadn't come to him and whined and complained. If Laban hadn't gotten upset and lost his friendly face, would Jacob have been comfortable staying in Padan Aram? Padan Aram? It's interesting because we're going to see in a couple of weeks, I worked on this week, I texted Dustin and said this was a great week of study for me because I was studying Jacob's time in Shechem. Because the goal was always to get him back to Shechem, or back to his family. But as soon as Jacob crossed over in the land of Canaan, it's like he went, oh, I'm home. He wasn't home yet. So he lived in Shechem for 20 years, a Hittite city, and there are some major consequences as a result of that. He got comfortable living in Shechem. And that wasn't God's intent or God's plan. And sometimes as Christians, we're kind of like that. You know? Especially when we get to a place where we're not really sure, wait a minute, God, I thought your plan was something different, but now I'm here and I don't know exactly what your purpose and plan is for me here. And then we have a tendency, I think, sometimes to become a little bit comfortable right then and there. And God has to remind us, that's not my purpose, that's not my plan, there's something else. And oftentimes for us believers, it goes beyond just enjoying where we're at here and now. God's purpose and plan has always been to bless the families of the earth. And sometimes I think we as Christians forget that. You know, we get caught up in building our earthly treasures and other things here. We forget that, no, wait a minute. It isn't just about that. It goes beyond that. And God has to remind us of our commitment to him, much like he did Jacob. Remember, Jacob, I need you to go back because my plan is back there. And oh, by the way, you made a commitment to me so that when you get back there, we can fulfill this. And so God had to remind Jacob of both of those things. Maybe it was because Jacob needed to be reminded of those things. Now, as we look at the rest of this chapter, what we're going to see here is that God acted to ensure the success of that. So it wasn't just enough for God to remind him of his purpose and plan for Jacob. It wasn't just enough for God to remind Jacob of the commitment, the vow that he had made to him, that, yeah, I'll come back here to my family and I will make you my God. That wasn't enough, because God now demonstrated to him, through a series of things we're going to see here, that he would ensure the success of his plan. The first way we see God do this was by warning Laban not to threaten or mistreat Jacob. Look at what happens in verses 22 through 35. It's a big chunk, but chapter 31. Because Laban obviously isn't happy. He comes home to discover that Jacob is gone with his wives and his and it would have been Laban's grandchildren and all of his stuff. And look at what happens. When it was told Laban on the third day that Jacob had fled, that he took his kinsmen with him and pursued him a distance of 7 days' journey, and he overtook him in the hill country of Gilead. God came to Laban, the Aramean, in a dream of the night and said to him, "Be careful that you do not speak to Jacob either good or bad." Laban caught up with Jacob. Now Jacob had pitched his tent in the hill country, and Laban and his kinsmen camped in the hill country of Gilead. Then Laban said to Jacob, "What have you done by deceiving me and carrying away my daughters like captives of the sword? Why did you flee secretly and deceive me, and did not tell me so that I might have sent you away with joy and with songs, with tremble and with lyre, and did not allow me to kiss my sons and my daughters?" He's talking about his grandkids there primarily. His daughters, obviously his daughters, but the sons is probably a reference to his grandkids. "Now you have done foolishly. It is within my power to do you harm, but the God of your father spoke to me last night, saying, 'Be careful not to speak either good or bad to Jacob.' Now you have indeed gone away because you longed greatly for your father's house, but why did you steal my gods?" Then Jacob replied to Laban, "Because I was afraid, for I thought that you would take your daughters from me by force. The one with whom you find your God shall not live in the presence of our kinsmen. Point out what is yours among my belongings and take it for yourself." For Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them. So Laban went into Jacob's tent and into Leah's tent and into the tent of the two maids, but he did not find them. Then he went out of Leah's tent and entered Rachel's tent. Now Rachel had taken the household idols and put them in the camel's saddle, and she sat on them. And Laban fell through the tent, but he did not find them. So he said to her, "Let not my lord be angry in that I cannot rise before you," meaning get off the horse, "for the manner of women is upon me." So he searched, but did not find the household idols. Now that's a mouthful. Let's kind of break that down. So the first thing that we see here is God warns Laban not to do harm to Jacob, because that's what Laban's intent is at this point. He's even told him that I got the power to harm you, but no, God said I can't. Laban wasn't happy, and God knew Laban's intent, so he intervenes, tells him, "Don't speak either good or bad to Laban." Now that appears to be a figure of speech. If you want the fancy term for it, it's called a merism. It's where you take two opposite words, you join them together, like, you know, good or evil, something like that. It's sort of like the gamut, okay? And really what he's telling him here is not to harm him. Don't say anything good or bad to him. You be very careful. And it's interesting, this phrase I think is only used one other time, and it was used of Absalom back in 2 Samuel chapter 3, where it says Absalom did not speak to Amnon, either good or bad, for Absalom hated Amnon because he had violated his sister Tamar. I remember the story where Tamar was violated or raped by Amnon. Absalom obviously is irritated and frustrated and angry and enraged about it, but it says that he spoke neither good nor bad to Amnon. I mean, he didn't bring him harm. And so that's really what's going on here. So God warns him, you better not do anything to harm David. Now, Laban did accuse David or of Jacob of a couple of things here. God didn't say that he couldn't talk to him. Couldn't bring harm to him, though. So the first thing he accused him of here was secretly carrying off his daughters like prisoners of war. Look back at verses 26 through 28. "What have you done by deceiving me and carrying away my daughters like captives by the sword?" earlier, the text, if you go back, you don't have to run there, but chapter 31, the very middle or so, verses 15 through 17, his daughters were more than willing to go with Jacob. In fact, they looked at their father and they said, he's wasted the dowry that he was paid on our behalf, and there's nothing left in his estate for us. So yeah, let's go back home. Let's go back to your home, Jacob. I mean, it's pretty much a paraphrase, the Michael Pappan paraphrase. So his assertion, you took them away like captives. Talk about the melodrama here. He didn't take them away like captives. They went willingly. He accused Jacob of depriving him of an opportunity to kiss his daughters and his grandsons goodbye. And notice he even says to send them away with gladness and with songs and with tambourine and with lyre. Do you really think that Laban would have sent them away like that? Especially knowing what we know later in verse 31. They're mine! My daughters, my grandkids, my animals, mine, 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 mine. No. This is deceit. It's interesting you have this word deceive, deceive, deceive show up in here. Who's the one doing the deceiving here? So it's all nonsense. It's pure deception. Jacob left secretly because he knew Laban and his character. He believed that Laban would take his daughters back by force. Everything he needed to know about Laban, he knew. According to chapter 31, verse 29, if God had not intervened by warning Laban, Laban would have carried out his plan to harm Jacob. Look at verse 29 again, just briefly. It is in my power to do you harm. But the God of your father spoke to me last night, saying, be careful not to speak good or bad to Jacob. What does that tell us? Laban would have hurt him, given the opportunity. And the only reason he didn't was because God intervened. And why did God intervene? Protecting his purpose, protecting his plan. The second thing that Laban accused Jacob of was stealing his gods. This is kind of a weird part of the text. There are just times where you get some weird stuff going on here. But look at verse 30. Now you have indeed gone away because you longed greatly for your father's house, but why did you steal my gods? He was referring to the teraphim. Back in verse 19, it says that Rachel took the teraphim. When Laban had gone to shear his flock, then Rachel stole the household idols, the teraphim, that were her father's. Now it's not really clear what those were. Most Bible translations translate teraphim as household idols, but it's interesting because this word is used throughout the scriptures combined in other passages where it's placed alongside graven and molten images, placed alongside idols. And usually when you have two words and one word means something, the other word generally doesn't mean that same thing. So maybe a little bit confusing here, but it's unlikely that teraphim were specifically household idols. Because again, those were something different. According to Hosea chapter 3, verse 4, and Zechariah chapter 10, verse 2, teraphim were used in forms of divination. They were to learn oracles, if you will, from the gods. And so, if you remember, back in chapter 30, Laban said that he had divined something about how God had blessed him through Jacob. He says that, I've learned through divination that God has blessed me. It's likely that these teraphim were what Laban used to get information from God. It's a way that, you know, think about it, even in the Old Testament they would cast lots to determine whether what God's will was. And it appears that that's really what was happening here. And so that then begs the question, why did Rachel steal them from her father? One speculation is that the reason she stole them from her father was because she didn't want her father divining where they were and how to find them. Again, partly speculation. But regardless, whatever these were, they were used in some cultic practice to divine God's will. And so it likely would have been that he got home, he knew that they were gone, he went to get his teraphim to divine, where did they go, how do I find them, discovered they weren't there, so now he sets out and takes him 7 days to track down Jacob. And so he's not happy about these teraphim being taken by who he thinks ultimately is Jacob here. But we find out in verse 32 that Jacob was totally oblivious to it. Verse 32, "The one with whom you find your gods shall not live," that's the teraphim again, "your teraphim shall not live in the presence of our kinsmen. Point out what is yours among my belongings and take it for yourself." And then it tells us, "For Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them." So he was totally oblivious to the fact that Rachel had taken these. And again, we know that she did. Verses 34 through 42, we discover, "Now Rachel had taken the household idols, the teraphim, and put them in the camel's saddle, and she sat on them. And Laban felt through all the tents, but he did not find them." And so we have this situation where Jacob says, "I don't have them, but you're free to look through the whole entire camp here. And if you find them, it's going to stink to be that guy." And so Laban takes him up on it. He starts digging through all this. They can't find him anywhere. Going all over the place. You know, he goes into the tent. He can't find him. And so, ultimately, he comes to Rachel, who has them. But she's pretty smart. She hides him in the saddle there. And she's sitting on it. But because it's the time of month, or that's what the excuse is, he's not going to have her get up off of that because that's improper. And so she uses this very deceptive plan here so that he can't actually discover that she's hiding these teraphim. So, what do we see with this? God is ultimately protecting Jacob from these accusations. Certainly had Laban found these, there would have been consequences to pay. But again, he was completely aware. He's being honest here. He didn't know. He's not lying. He's not being deceptive. He didn't know she had done it. And that actually then leads us to the second way that God ensured his purpose and plan here. You got these accusations, but one of the things that God does here, and this comes out in the text, is that God ensures the success of his plan by upholding justice for Jacob. He had been falsely accused. If you look at verses 34 through 42 again, it says that the one whom you find your God shall not live. The presence of your kinsmen point, or in the presence of your kinsmen, point out what is yours among my belongings and take it for yourself. For Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them. Now, had Laban found them in the presence of Rachel, he would have just assumed Jacob's in on it. Jacob's lying. Jacob's being deceitful. So Laban went into Jacob's tent and into Leah's tent and into the tent of the two maids, but he didn't find them. Then he went out to Leah's tent and entered Rachel's tent. Now Rachel had taken the household idols and put them in the camel's saddle, and she sat on them. And Laban felt through all the tents, but he didn't find them. So she said to her father, "Let not my lord be angry if I cannot rise before you, for the manner of women is upon me." So he searched, but did not find the household idols. And look at this. Then Jacob became angry and contended with Laban. And Jacob said to Laban, "What is my transgression? What is my sin that you have so hotly pursued me? Though you have felt through all my goods, and you have found what have you found of all your household goods? Set it here before my kinsmen and your kinsmen, and they may decide between us two." These 20, and this is where it really kind of rubber meets the road here. "These 20 years I have been with you, your ewes and your female goats have not miscarried, nor have I eaten the rams of your flock." That would have been something that would have been expected. When a shepherd was caring for somebody's flocks, he got to take his food from those flocks. And Jacob said, "I didn't even do that." "That which was torn of beasts," meaning animals that had been killed of the flock, "I didn't bring to you. I bore the loss of it myself. You required it of my hand, whether stolen by day or stolen by night." So he basically is saying, "Look, I served you for all these years. I suffered loss because of you, because even when your sheep were killed or were stolen, I didn't come to you and say, 'Look, they were I covered it myself. It cost me something, not you.'" Thus I was, by day the heat consumed me, and the frost by night, and my sleep fled from my eyes, meaning he had worked night and day. These 20 years I have been in your house. I served you 14 years for your daughters and 6 years for your flock, and you changed my wages 10 times. So through all of this, Jacob is thinking, and you've got the gall to come to me and accuse me of stealing your idols. Something so petty as these teraphim. Now again, he didn't know that Rachel had taken them, but the reality of it is, he didn't take them. And Jacob had set an example before Laban. Laban should have known. So when Jacob said, I didn't take your idols, that should have been the end of it. Because Jacob had proven his character before Laban. And so this is where the upholding of justice comes in. Look at verse 42. If the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had not been for me, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. Meaning, he would have taken his wives, his daughters back from Jacob. He would have taken the grandchildren, would have taken all of his possessions and belongings and sent Jacob home all by himself. But then he says this, God has seen my affliction and the toil of my hands, so he rendered judgment last night. What does he mean by that? He basically means, he's saying to Laban, I'll paraphrase, Laban, when God spoke to you last night and said you're not to lay a hand on me, that was God's judgment. That was his vindication. That was God making it right for me because of all of the harm that you've caused me. For all that I've done for you, and you've taken, and you've taken, and you've taken, and you've taken. For the mistreatment, for the deceit, for the cheating, for all of that, God has issued his judgment. He has vindicated me. When he came to you last night and said, don't lay a hand on Jacob. And so we have this other example here of God protecting his purpose and his plan for Jacob by ultimately upholding justice for Jacob. There's one last way that I believe we see God ensure his success and his plan. And that's that he actually mediated peace between Laban and Jacob. Takes it to a different level. Look at verses 43 through 55. We'll finish up with these verses here. Then Laban replied to Jacob, the daughters are my daughters, and the children are my children, and the flocks are my flocks, and all that you see is mine. But what can I do this day to these my daughters, or to their children whom they've borne? And in essence, what he's saying here is, he's still frustrated, he's still angry, that's all mine! But I can't do anything about it. You lucky little savage, Jacob, I can't do anything about it. He's right. Why? Because God had warned him. So now, come, let us make a covenant. In other words, let us make peace, you and I. Let it be a witness between you and me. Then Jacob took a stone and he set it up as a pillar. Jacob said to his kinsmen, gather the stones. So they took stones and made a heap, and they ate there by the heap. That's an important part of a covenant. Peace covenant is eating together. That's what they did. Now Laban called it Jegar Sahadatha, but Jacob called it Gilead. Laban said, this heap is a witness between you and me this day. Therefore it was named Gilead. And Mizpah, for he said, may the Lord watch between you and me when we are absent from one another. If you mistreat my daughters, or if you take wives beside my daughters, although no man is with us, see, God is witness between you and me. What he does there is he basically tells Jacob, don't mistreat my daughters. God's watching you to make sure it doesn't happen. Laban said to Jacob, behold this heap, and behold the pillar which I have set between you and me. This heap is a witness, and the pillar is a witness, that if I not pass by this heap to you for harm, and you will not pass by this heap and this pillar to me for harm. In other words, what he's saying there is, I'm going to set up this pillar. Neither one of us can cross this boundary again. I'll stay away from you. you stay away from me. That's going to protect both sides. The God of Abraham, the God of Nahor, the God of their father, let him judge between us. So Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac. It means he swore by God. Then Jacob offered a sacrifice on the mountain and called his kinsmen to the meal. It's another important part of making a covenant is the sacrificial animal. And they ate the meal and spent the night on the mountain. Early in the morning, Laban rose and he kissed his sons and his daughters and blessed them. Then Laban departed and returned to his place. So what do we make with all of that? Well, Laban's response to Jacob was a mix of both defiance and defeat. He's still angry. They're all mine! But I can't do anything about it. So he kind of admits defeat. But not only that, but notice that Laban is the one here that initiates the peace covenant between them. That's an act of God. When he makes your enemies be the ones that call for peace because they realize they can't do anything about it. And that's what God does here with Laban. God's warning had apparently motivated him to seek peace with Jacob rather than to cause him harm and then take all of his stuff back. So God mediates this peace. In fact, God is the mediator of it because Laban says that God will serve as the witness and the judge. The overwhelming sense we get from this passage is that Laban initiated the peace covenant out of his own self-interest, but ultimately what it did was it put an end to the tension between Laban and Jacob. It put an end to the possible mistreatment of Jacob. That segment of his life is done. He's now going back to the land of Canaan with a lot of stuff. God had made him wealthy, not only with the children, but the servants and everything that he owned. But there's this giant monkey now off his back. A man who had been literally a thorn in his flesh for 20 plus years, God has now removed that and brought peace. And just this reminder here that Laban himself said, we'll set this pillar up as a place where I won't pursue you beyond this, but you don't come back here as well. Means that Jacob is going back to the land in peace. So what do we do with that in terms of a takeaway for ourselves then? I think all of this is a perfect example of what the Bible tells us in Romans 8:28, which is that God causes all things to work together for good for those who love Him, but also those who are called according to His purpose. Now, we've mentioned that quite a bit as we've been through our study here in the last few weeks because we see how God is doing that with Jacob. Remember, He reminded Jacob of His plan and Jacob's vow to Him at the very beginning of this because he was stuck in Padan-Aram for 20 plus years. Where was God's purpose and plan? And so He reminds him of that because God is working all things together for good, His purpose and His plan. Not just for Jacob, who He promised to bless in the land, but also for all of mankind. That's God's purpose, that's God's plan, and He works out all things according to good for those who are called according to His purpose. Jacob had been called according to God's purpose. But have we not been as well? Why are you and I saved? Was it just to save us? Or does God have a purpose and a plan beyond that? I would argue that there's something beyond that. God could have sucked each one of us up with a giant Hoover when He saved us. If His only benefit or His only purpose was, I'm going to bless you, then it could have all just ended with Him saying, live on the land, be fat, be happy, you know, here's your check, live large. But He didn't. Because He called us according to His purpose, not our purpose, His purpose. Jesus reminds us of what that is in the Great Commission. Go therefore. Notice, if you got into the language there, it says not go as a command, but it says as you are going, as you're living this life, in the blessings that I've given to you, as you are going, make disciples by baptizing and teaching. God's purpose. And He works out good for us as He works us towards His purpose and plan. And we have to keep that in mind. And we see that here with Jacob. God's purpose and plan, yes, He wants to bless us. And sometimes we get a little stuck. find ourselves in a place where we're like, oh my God, I thought your plan was, but why am I here? What, you know, like I said, I spent 2 years twiddling my thumbs, and I don't like to twiddle my thumbs. You know, there's a part of me that feels burdened to teach. I feel guilty if I wouldn't. But I also derive a tremendous amount of pleasure from it. So there's a selfish motive. So sitting 2 years at Grace, getting frustrated, part of that was, I just missed doing it. But part of it was I felt like, God, I thought you sent me there for a reason and a purpose. What was behind all this? If I'm just going to sit here and twiddle my thumbs, why? What's the value in that? What's the purpose in that? God reminds us he's got a purpose and a plan. There may be a little valley here and there. There may be 20 years in Pan Aram like Jacob, but God did not forget about his purpose and plan. And so he reminds Jacob, but in that reminder also reminds Jacob of the vow he made to him. But then he also worked to protect that, meaning that sometimes we get a little bit disillusioned. I think about, you know, we went through 4 years here just recently of, you know, when we look at our nation and a lot of us struggled in the direction of the country and all that stuff that, you know, we get all the political stuff and we get discouraged. But did God forget about his purpose and plan? No, he didn't. And now we have kind of the opposite. I saw yesterday an executive order, yesterday, the day before, about the new office of, I don't know what it is. It's basically a new governmental office that's supposed to investigate and look into attacks against Christians and other people of faith, you know, whatever you want to call it. So we all rejoice. Woohoo! God's back on the throne. Well, he never left the throne. But we kind of get in our little perspective, right? You know? But God hasn't forgotten about his purpose and his plan, whether it's for us or overall in general. And so he reminds us of both his purpose and plan. He reminds us of our commitment to him. But then he will always continue to protect that. He will bring about his purpose and plan. Even if it may be like we're in the desert for a little bit. Amen?